I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A CDC study of autism in adults, which came out last year, found that 2.2% of American adults have an autism spectrum condition. That's one in 45 Americans. So chances are you know someone with autism spectrum disorder, or you know someone who knows someone. Broadly speaking, someone with this diagnosis can have trouble making conversation or eye contact. They may prefer more solitary activities and may take some extra steps to process and understand emotions. And there are pluses, the ability to be hyper-focused and become expert in a particular topic. But no one is just their diagnosis. Our guests, Sarah and Larry Nannery, are a neurodiverse family. She was recently diagnosed with ASD, autism spectrum disorder, and he is what is called neurotypical. They've written a book about what it's like to navigate all the challenges of a long-term relationship, and it's titled What to Say Next. Sarah Nannery is Director of Development for Autism Initiatives at Drexel University, joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Sarah Nannery, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us, Larry Nannery. He's a technology consultant. He specializes in organizational change and life coaching. And Larry Nannery, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to make sure that you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I want to start with some words because I want to make sure that we're all on the same page when we talk about things like neurodiversity or autism spectrum disorder or neurotypical or a neurodiverse family or even what Asperger's is. So I just want to make sure that we're all going to use the same language. And Sarah, if I could just start with you, what does it mean when we hear about autism spectrum disorder? What does that mean and what does that entail?
Yeah, it's a little bit, it's changed recently. You know, there's no longer a diagnosis for Asperger's syndrome. And so it's all kind of under the umbrella of autism spectrum disorder. There is a movement within the autistic community to change it to autism spectrum condition or just autism spectrum, you know, because this word disorder can be very loaded. But, you know, it entails a lot of different things that fall under this spectrum now. And then when you broaden it out even further to neurodiversity, neurodiversity includes not just autism, but also other ways that people's brains might work differently, such as if someone has dyslexia or if they have ADHD. A lot of other things fall under the neurodiversity umbrella as well.
So are we talking about people's brains? We should welcome diversity in the world, but is that sort of what's different?
Yeah, it has to do with different ways that people perceive the world and then interact with the world based on how their neurology might be different.
I want to get back to you, but let me get to you, Larry. Neurotypical, again, you know, I struggled with that word. I think you do as well.
Yeah, I appreciate using the word in the discussion. I am a unique person. I'm comprised of my own traits, my own personality, and I am unique. And I think that the less that we focus on being typical, but instead being a good person and having good relationships and good communication, I think that we'll be more successful. So.
And you are, I mean, here's another one. You are then a neurodiverse family. Is that Larry? I'm
absolutely. Back at you. It's, you know what we are? We are a family that celebrates our uniquenesses, that understands our traits, and tries our best to give a moment to whatever our needs are, our children's needs are. That's what we are.
Sarah, let me go back to you. And you write about this in your book, and I have to say to our listeners that it's largely your story. Larry, you get to put in your two cents. I think that's what it says. So you get to add your two cents. But in many ways, Sarah, it's about you. Mm-hmm. Help us understand when you were a little girl, what kind of a little girl you were.
Mm-hmm. I was definitely, like the odd girl out, you know. I had a wonderful childhood. My mother, who's probably listening, was an amazing mother. I had a lovely sister. You know, it was just a few different things that were different for me growing up. You know, I didn't fit in with other kids. I ended up engaging in a lot of what we call like social mimicry to try and, mimic what I saw other kids doing who maybe were the cool kids, and I never really quite got it right because I didn't understand the context or, you know, how to do it the way they were doing it. I ended up with the label of tomboy, which a lot of girls who are autistic and other neurodiverse end up with, because I wasn't interested in a lot of the things that girls play with. Now, there are a lot of autistic girls who are very girly, right? This is, you know, it's a spectrum. But I ended up, just having trouble finding a social groove to fit into.
You wrote that you were bookish.
Mm-hmm.
And you like to do solitary things.
Mm-hmm.
And that later in high school, you were one of like the nerds, right?
Yes.
I mean, you're looking at one. I was a nerd as well, but
yeah.
You know, a different kind of nerd.
Mm-hmm.
But that was your group.
Yeah. I ended up finding music and being able to fit into kind of the band geek culture, which helped a lot. And that actually propelled me through college as well. I was one of the band geeks.
And you were a good student, right?
Yes.
And like school, I mean, maybe the structure of school, the stuff that just felt spoke to you.
Yeah, it did. It gave me what I was looking for in terms of that structure. Exactly. So I knew where my skills were useful. I knew what the rules were. I knew how to get an A, you know, and I just followed the rules to be able to get that good grade. It was the social aspect that just never clicked.
Now, you have this diagnosis, you know, for lack of a better word, autism spectrum condition. Let's use that. What does that mean to you? I mean, how was that helpful for you to know?
Yeah.
Did that help to describe some of who you are?
Yeah. Yeah, it did. I think back, like, would it have been different if I had the diagnosis earlier? I don't know necessarily that it would have. It might have helped in terms of understanding some of what I was going through. But we all go through our own kind of self-awareness journeys. And when I got to finally be in a place where I had a career and I was married and I had kids, then it all sort of came together and I realized that I needed something else. I needed more help. So the diagnosis for me, even coming later in life, was actually very freeing. You know, it was a little scary at first, and I think we spent a little bit of time, both Larry and I, deciding whether we really wanted to pursue a diagnosis and what it would mean, because I didn't want it to change anything about us or about the way that we had learned how to work together for the last 10 years. But it ended up really being liberating for me because I could finally understand, you know, I don't have certain character flaws that I thought I might have. I have brain differences that make it difficult or takes more work for me to do certain things.
I want to pick up on that as well, but let me go back to you, Larry. You describe, you were in Penn Station where you first laid eyes on Sarah.
I was at Starbucks in a line, and there was this cute girl who was stuck on her phone in February in a snowstorm, and we're all trying to figure out things. So I thought, let me just engage with her. 3 hours later of talking and getting to know each other, there was just something unique and very, very precocious, very special about this person that I wanted to get to know better. I didn't at that time realize the effort it was going to take to unlock some of what Sarah wanted to bring to this world. Every time I would speak, she'd want to send me a text message back, which is a very interesting way of communicating, but
it's not speaking.
Well, you know, but it is communicating, and it is getting her words out in the best way that she was able to do so.
Well, help us understand that, because you write about this process of learning how to communicate with each other. I'm looking at you, Larry, but I want to get Sarah, you back in on the conversation, which was learning how to sort of understand why it would take her some time to kind of process what was going on, and then she could, in writing, respond to you.
Well, I'm fortunate that my background in technology with a lot of offshore people, people who don't speak English as a first or maybe even a second language, interns coming into the technology field and overwhelmed with acronyms. So I have a background in just be successful in getting through what you want to. And that gave me a lot of patience, maybe not as much as I needed at times, but again, I am human. It just allowed me to say, Sarah, get your words out however it is. If it's an email 4 hours later, fabulous. Can we park it and go have a different conversation? Great. And if not, I'll give you a little space when you're ready, when you've got it through your head. Put it out there, and we will continue this.
So what does writing? I mean, and I have to say to our listeners, I really wanted you to come in, but also knowing that this might be a bit of a challenge for you just because you're a very good writer and maybe more comfortable in writing. But what does writing give you?
It gives me time, honestly. It just takes me a little bit longer to process information than it might take most other people. And it's because I'm taking in so much of it. I see every detail. I'm very detail oriented. And so it's hard for me to filter out, okay, what's the most important thing that I need to be focusing on? What is it that I need to be saying right now, as opposed to the million other things that I could be saying? So writing allows me to have that processing time to be able to put down exactly what it is that I want to say and make it perfect. You know, that's the other thing too is...
Well, I was going to say perfect.
Yeah. There's a lot of perfectionism that comes along with this.
Why is that? Why do you have to be perfect?
I think so. It's another part of just the way that my brain works. And I know this is the same way for a lot of other people who are autistic, but also, you know, not for others. I have a very black and white way of thinking about things. So if something is not 100% right, then it's wrong.
Oh. So it can't, nothing in the middle.
No gray area, exactly, which is just untenable. You can't live life that way. That's very hard to do. So because nothing in life is perfect. And so this is something I've had to really work on, and that Larry has helped me with, is being able to navigate the gray area where if something is 85% or even 75% okay, it's okay to move on, right? It's okay to get it out and move on to the next thing.
We're almost up in a break here. You want to add anything quickly to that, Larry?
Just that it's a constant struggle, but it's beautiful to see that, especially with the kids, you feel more and more comfortable getting with that 85%. And if you have to go adjust later, it's okay, and you find the successes.
I mean, with kids, well, we'll get to kids. Yeah, nothing is perfect,
right.
But you probably know that. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Sarah and Larry Nannery. They've got a new book. It's called What to Say Next, Successful Communication in Work, Life, and Love with Autism Spectrum Disorder. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Sarah Nannery and Larry Nannery. Sarah is a director of development for autism initiatives at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. Larry Nannery is a technology consultant. He specializes in organizational change and life coaching. And we're talking about their book that just came out a couple of months ago called What to Say Next. Let me pick up on a couple of things about communication. One of them, and I was saying this to you, Sarah, during the break, you're not the only person who hates small talk. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that has been a challenge for you. And explain to our listeners why.
Sure. Yeah, definitely not the only person who dislikes small talk. I think, you know, for me personally, I never really understood what the purpose was of it, because I wasn't getting the kind of the serotonin that your brain will often give you when you're just connecting, you know, on a surface level with another person, that wasn't happening for me. So I'm like, why are we talking about this inane, you know, the weather or sports that I don't even care about? But when I realized that for most people, that just kind of really nice casual connection gives them a feel-good feeling, then I can kind of cut through and do it for a few minutes. And then after a few minutes, when we get into more deeper conversation, that's when I start to get the feel-good chemicals. Oh. So it pays off in the end.
But in that small talk where you're talking about the weather or whatever, mm-hmm. you don't get that feeling of connection?
Yeah. No. Yeah. It's all fear right then for me. I'm like, I gotta run away or, you know, engage.
Larry, go ahead.
I wanted to say that it actually costs you what we call our hit points. Mm-hmm. And the small talk is a negative before you get to that larger conversation. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully that conversation then is restorative and mm-hmm. you at least get back to where you were before the conversation started.
But you have to sort of endure the small talk, right, to get to the conversation. Because as you write, Sarah, it's like for you, conversation is about sharing information. Mm-hmm. It's like, or imparting information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that sort of describe what it is?
Yeah, for me, I think what it is it's like a disconnect kind of between the emotional experience of communication and the informational experience of communication, because it takes a lot more in-depth communication for me to start getting that emotional response that I know now that a lot of other people get towards the beginning of an interaction with someone. So I've always thought of communication as, you know, I have something that I need to tell you. I'm going to tell you what it is. I don't need to talk about the weather first. But a lot of other people need to have this kind of common grounding that makes everybody feel comfortable. So in order for me to feel comfortable, I help other people feel comfortable. And then, you know, we can communicate.
Oh, that's great. So how have you had to learn how to communicate, Larry?
Well, so all of what Sarah just said is that establishing rapport. And I think for me, that comes extremely naturally. I love to be in a room. I love to go and interact with people. I don't need to talk about the weather. There's other things that we can talk about. The squirrel in New York City, that was interesting. But just having some common interest means that you feel more comfortable with that person. You're not an adversary. You know, you're sitting at a bar just relaxing, drinking a glass of wine. It's a shared communal experience. And that in humanity, that's what we've done for eons. So helping Sarah understand that value, even if mm-hmm. it was from a data college level conversation to say, this is why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. Once it was unlocked and she saw the positives of it. And again, I'll say, and I know we'll talk about kids later, but with the kids, seeing that established confidence on a playground is huge and positive.
One of the things you describe, and I'm back to you, Sarah, in terms of a conversation, I thought this was a really interesting metaphor about creating a sandwich. You've got the bread, and then you lay on the, let's say, peanut butter, and then mm-hmm. the jelly, and mm-hmm. then the bread.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking of a conversation like that is helpful for you.
Yeah, it helps to have a framework for something as unstructured as a conversation. Because for me, you know, it's hard for me to, in real time, to pick up on cues that someone might be giving that they want to talk or that they have thought to add to the conversation. So if I follow my framework of, you know, making a sandwich, not mine, it's something I found.
Sure.
I supply a piece of the conversation and then I wait for the other person to put their piece in. And that helps to establish a better flow for otherwise I would let them do all the talking or I would be the one doing all the talking.
Right. You would be making the sandwich or they would be. So this is the building of the sandwich together. Let me add another thing. And Larry, I'll go back to you. And this is about humor and sarcasm and irony, you know, all the things that not all the things, but a lot of things that people do when they talk to each other.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people use humor and irony and such to break the ice, to get rid of some awkwardness. And for Sarah, until she goes back and thinks about it, all of that goes over her head. So not only is the ice not broken, But there's this deficit now of, oh, I was supposed to understand that. And I can see Sarah's brain working through. So in joint social interactions, I will take the lead of introducing, of breaking the ice, of establishing names and some form of rapport, just so that we can move on to the more enjoyable parts of the conversation.
And for you, Sarah, then humor is just, it's too abstract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what it is it's too real time. It's too fast. I need some more processing time. So often I'll get a joke, but I'll be the last one in the room to get it, or I'll get it several hours later after I've thought about it. And I can use humor, but my humor is very much this kind of slower, like a slow burn humor, which can be very funny. And there's a lot of autistic people who are very funny. It's just for me, it happens a little bit too fast. And so I write in the book a lot about ways that I've figured out how to kind of fake it in the moment. Like, you know, if I see people laughing, I'll smile, you know, or if I can pick up on cues that someone is about to tell a joke, I'll kind of switch into, okay, we're in joke mode. You know, it's a lot to do in real time.
Is this hard for you? I mean, here we are having this conversation on the radio. Is this hard for you?
It is. Yeah, it is. But it's also it's a way that I grow, you know, so there's always more that I can learn. And it takes a lot more for me to learn, I think, than some other people might.
Is this hard for you, Larry?
No, this is very relaxing. The only hard part is seeing Sarah, and we're far enough away that I can't really hold her hand too much. But
but you know this is hard for her.
I know it's hard, but it's not hard as if she's climbing a mountain. It's hard as it's 100 first interactions, because every question you ask, well, oh, I have to now prepare. What is that conversation? It helps that we've had a few interviews. It helps how comfortable you are in talking us through. So it's more of a narrative. Mm-hmm. If this was on a podium with 100 different questions, that would be a nightmare mm-hmm. for Sarah.
There's a lot going on in this room, too. There's a TV set on, there are mm-hmm. lights, there's, you know, there are clocks and things like that. Is that distracting to you, or can you focus?
It's both. So, I mentioned that the lighting in here is actually very nice. It's not too blaring, which is nice. And it's nice that I'm actually looking at you and not the screen, and all the stuff is behind me for you to look at, right. Which is nice. So that does help, but it is distracting. You know, I think more distracting for me than it might be for maybe other people, because like I said earlier, I'm just taking in so many more details. Like, I'm fascinated by this coaster that you have under the mugs.
Which is very busy, lots of colors.
It's very busy. But it does help me too, because I can look at that, you know, when I'm trying to come up with what it is that I should say next. And it helps to ground me a little bit as well. So it goes both ways.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Got a lot of comments here. That's Sarah Nannery, who joins us along with her husband, Larry Nannery. They've got a new book. It's called What to Say Next, and it's subtitled Successful Communication in Work, Life, and Love with Autism Spectrum Disorder. As I mentioned earlier, Sarah Nannery is Director of Development for Autism Initiatives at Drexel University, and Larry Nannery is a technology consultant. And we want to hear from you. Again, you can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Pamela. She says, according to a family member's therapist, Asperger's syndrome was ended as a diagnosis and merged into ASD purely for insurance reasons, since health insurance would cover treatment for ASD but not for Asperger's. I'm not sure if, Larry, I'm going to toss that back to you. I did not know this, if it's true. Yeah.
So there's a lot that is talked about on why Asperger's was retired. It's not something I want to get too deeply into, but there is a historical, political rationale that was attached to that word. And just for moving forward in our modern world, it was probably best overall that language was retired and folded into ASD. But of course, that adds a whole nother layer of complexity because the spectrum grew. It's a larger pool of people trying to understand their traits and their personalities.
Here's another comment, one from Patty, who says, I was diagnosed with Asperger's when I was 53. I observed the date of my diagnosis as a second birthday. I finally had an answer for why I struggled and was baffled as to why. I'm glad to live in a time when there's more awareness about neurodiversity, but I'm careful about disclosing it, especially in employment. There are still those who need to be educated. And I really appreciate that, Patty. Yeah. I mean, it's frankly why we wanted to have both of you on, because mm-hmm. I think we all need an education. There's so much important new yeah. information about that. Do you want to respond to her at all?
Yeah, Sarah? Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Patty. And, you know, I think that Patty and I are part of a large demographic of specifically women who were diagnosed later in life. Right now, there was a lot of us who were missed when we were children, largely because most of the people being diagnosed when we were kids were boys. And, it's just how the diagnostics worked. So there are a lot of women now who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, all across the age gamut being diagnosed. And it is a relief. It's an amazing relief. Because suddenly now I know this thing about myself that makes me, part of who I am. And I think, the other piece that she's talking about employment and whether mm-hmm. to disclose, it is tough. There is a lot of stigma still around autism. And I think for me, when I talk about what it is for me to be autistic in employment, I usually will just talk about what I need. I don't necessarily have to disclose the diagnosis. I need the ability to lower my lights, or I need to be able to wear a visor, or I need a quiet space. That's what I will usually go to first when I'm talking about employment.
Yeah. Well, I had the pleasure, frankly, the honor of interviewing Temple Grandin a couple of times, and
great.
That was a real revelation. But I'm thinking of the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just think of all the people with this diagnosis who are out changing the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I think that, when the stat you mentioned in the beginning, 1 in 45 people is autistic. I think that there's actually quite a few more than that. And we have so many different, we're as diverse as anybody else is diverse. This is why it's such an amazing spectrum, because you have people from all walks of life who are autistic and may not even know it. And, we have so much to offer.
Well, it's interesting. In your section of the book about the workplace, you do quote Temple Grandin, mm-hmm. who said the world needs different kinds of minds to work together. I mean, it's so true and so profound, Larry.
it really is. It gets back to that. For the purposes of this interview and book, I am neurotypical, but I am me, and I have my own interests, and I loved computers from when I was 8 years old, taking it apart with a little soldering iron and causing havoc for my parents. The more that we talk about our humanity, the more we talk about who we are, what we want to do, how we can come together, if it's in an office building with 100 people, if it's a small little nonprofit, if it's your church group. Everybody does what they do. We have the baker. We have the person who makes the signs. Now that we're using this new language and labels and everything, it doesn't mean that all of that isn't still perfectly viable and still around.
I saw a quote from the actor Anthony Hopkins, who said, apparently he said he realized a couple of years ago that he also was on the spectrum. And he told, this was the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, this was in 2020. It's a great gift, actually, he said. I was a bit slow as a school kid, so I made up for it by working hard. And I became, a successful actor. Obsessiveness about the details. Can you relate to that, Sarah?
Yeah, for sure. Obsessiveness about the details, yes, that very much. And I think that bit about working harder, too. Life is just a little bit harder for me and for a lot of people. And I think when you have this expectation to you want to be successful in life, and it's going to take me a little bit extra time and a little extra work to get there than it might for someone else. And, you know, partly that's okay because I'm okay doing the extra work, and partly it's not okay because we shouldn't have to make people work extra hard. So it's both.
It's both. Yeah, Larry. Yeah.
You have this constraint of you can't fake it until you make it. Mm-hmm. And that means that you work obsessively hard to get it right the first time. And that's lovely when you have all the time in the world. But when you're in a day-to-day situation, that's very challenging. So that's one trait that we really find constantly you work with.
Mm-hmm. That's it. I was going to ask you about faking it until you're making it. Mm-hmm. But for you, Sarah, it has to be perfect, right? So it's hard to fake things when you have to do it right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've learned that a lot of people who are successful faked a whole lot of it. You know, your confidence really gets you pretty far, even without, you know, necessarily the stuff to back it up. And people will learn it later, or, you know, which just baffled me. I have to know everything before, and then I can go and succeed. And that takes extra time. I've really worked on, you know, like with Larry, like being able to get most of the way there and then letting my confidence that I'll be able to handle it, or, you know, things will work out, or I'll get help, propel me the rest of the way.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Sarah Nannery. She's Director of Development for Autism Initiatives at Drexel University. Her husband, Larry Nannery, is a technology consultant. And again, they have co-authored a new book. It's called What to Say Next: Successful Communication in Work, Life, and Love with Autism Spectrum Disorder. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We've got a lot more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Let me talk a little bit about emotions. We've been talking about communication, but you both had a piece in, where was this? Maybe Psychology Today. Where, Sarah, you talked about, or you wrote, remember that your words echo in my head for hours, sometimes days, after you say them, particularly if they are emotionally charged. There is little I can do to change this other than just try to ignore the repetition. But, I mean, I think anyone reacting to someone's strong emotions has an emotional response to that. Mm-hmm. And when you're partnered in a couple, things happen, things come up. So what is it like for you to process some of these strong emotions?
Yeah, it's, like you said, it's tough for anybody to process strong emotions. I think for me, just from the perspective of the being autistic, I feel things very, very deeply. It's kind of this black or white, it's like all or nothing kind of thing. So if I'm sad about something, I'm really sad. And so, or vice versa, if I'm happy, I can feel, you know, overly happy. So I always try and I've done this since I was a child, try to find that middle ground where I'm not really getting very excited, even about good things, so that I also don't get, you know, too depressed about other things. And so, you know, being in a relationship, it changes that a little bit because you really can't stay in the middle ground all the time. You're partnered with someone else, and emotions get in there, and especially about things that are important. And I think for me, what's been the best thing for learning how to process and I think move forward through some of the stronger emotional experiences is just remembering what is the most important thing. Oh. That for me, because I'm very detail oriented, and so having that mental moment to take a step back and really think about, okay, is it important that I feel hurt right now, or is it more important that we're together and we love each other and we're, you know, getting through things together? So that's for me how it works.
Right. So that takes time, right? You have to process it and sort of get to that point where you better understand it.
Yes.
I guess. I mean, that makes total sense. For you, Larry, yeah.
I wanted to say, especially the first few years, Sarah did a lot of journaling. Mm-hmm. And Sarah had a work journal where the daily events she could almost log and park there so that it wasn't echoing in her head. And there was a relationship journal for me. And then there was a personal journal about just how you experience the world. I don't think you do that as much. Part mm-hmm. of it is time. And I think part of it is you found how to pull out what's important and try to let go of some of that other stuff a little bit more in real time.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of you says it's sort of like cognitive therapy in a way. I mean, to be able to process things that happen or how you feel and sort of write your way through it as a form of therapy.
Mm-hmm, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think journaling for me, like Larry says, has been very important in terms of, well, the way that I communicate best is through written communication, I feel. I mean, it just because it helps me to really codify what my thoughts are. So being able to write it down and kind of relive it that way and then be able to put it aside helps.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the extra benefits of the old paper and pen is not only do you see the words, but you can see how your writing is. Was it really short? Is it bold? Is it messy? Mm. And that captures some of that subconscious emotion that you might never consciously become aware of, but that doesn't mean it's not happening and you're not aware of it at some level.
Let me quote something else. This is back to Psychology Today that you wrote. And I'll just sort of jump to the part where you write, Sarah, a lot of autistic kids and adults learn very differently than most people. I don't just pick things up as I go along, like cooking or how to shop or what to say to my neighbor when we meet unexpectedly at the corner. And then you go on to say, because I didn't learn a lot of these things growing up, others may have. My husband sometimes ends up with the role of teacher, which for us works just fine. Outsiders might see the surface of our dynamic and assume that it's unbalanced. But looking deeper, I teach him all kinds of things in return, even if I don't always know it. Larry, can you respond to that?
Yeah. You know, a lot of information on the internet says make it equitable. Everything should be 50-50. You cook, I clean. I clean, you cook. It's not that way. That's not how real life works. And finding the balance so that we are successful and happy every day. I cook 6 out of 7 days a week, and the 7th day I order pizza. Sarah does the dishes usually 4 out of 7 days, and we struggle through. Right. So finding what your balance is, whatever that is, and don't make it 50-50, make it successful.
Well, that's interesting. And you write about when you were looking for an apartment, Sarah, you were really good at doing all the research, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, just digging down and finding right. all these places to go. And whereas you, once you got to the apartment, you, Larry, could kind of eyeball the place and say, oh, this might work or this is not going to work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In my head, I have a whiteboard. So okay. it all feels that's where I'm living.
Right. Mm-hmm. In your whiteboard. Anything you want to add to that, Sarah?
Yeah, well, I would just say that it's important to find that balance, even if it's not, like Larry said, like 50-50. A lot of times the balance is a different, you know, equation. And it really just depends on how you make each other successful in the relationship. And so sometimes I feel like I could do more, or, you know, I'm not doing enough, or Larry's doing so much because he's handling so much of the executive functioning of how the family runs and the household. And but I'm contributing in other ways, you know, in terms of insight for our son, you know, who's also autistic, or just some of the depth or the details that help us get through.
Yeah. And having a son with a similar diagnosis, then, I mean, do you feel like you understand, you see like the little you in him?
Child? Yeah. In a lot of ways, there's definitely a lot of symmetry with what he's experiencing. And I can sometimes get to what his thought process is a little quicker because I might have that that background. But also, he's very different than the way that I was at that age.
Anything you want to add to that? Well, and then I'll get back to some of our comments here.
So you had said something earlier about if the diagnosis would have changed Sarah, if she would have had it earlier. I would say that with Cyrus, having the diagnosis has allowed us to be preemptive on certain things. Since he's 1.5, I've been taking him to coffee shops and restaurants so that he could learn how to communicate. And it's somewhere between mechanical and automatic for him now. Mm-hmm. He can go in and order a milk stout at a local bar. He's very talented.
Good for it. At 1.5, that's not bad.
It's fabulous. A little dog cafe. He understands that he has to put effort in it, and at times he says hi to everybody at Target because he knows that he's trying to establish rapport and doesn't know what he's going to get back, so it's interesting. But at least he has this tool. Yeah. So the more that we see him grow, we identify those traits and are vigilant about helping him be mindful and figure out what he needs to put himself into, I think is a big benefit for him.
Yeah. I mean, that can be applied so much across the board to just raising children. Let me read some more comments. One from Ryan. I have autism, ADD, and a learning disability, plus I don't get social cues and have a very difficult time figuring out how other people are actually feeling. I don't feel anything when they're angry, sad, or anything else. I'm just blank, even when I want to be engaged. Any ideas on how to remedy this? Sarah, do you feel comfortable responding to Ryan there?
Yeah, I'm just me. I'm not a professional in any sense of this this realm. But I just, for me, I also get that sense of blankness when faced with, you know, other people's very strong emotions. And I think for me, I understand that that's part of my processing time that I need. You know, I will automatically put up some boundaries to protect myself, because if I, you know, tip over into what their emotions are, it's going to be, I won't be able to think, you know, I'll be taken away by the emotions. And that's not something that I am comfortable with. So I've been able to realize that I do it on purpose. I put up the blank boundary on purpose as a protective mechanism, and then I can later go in and kind of look, when I'm feeling at a safe distance, I can look at the emotions and what might be my reaction.
Mm-hmm. But while you put up that I don't want to say wall, mm-hmm. exactly, but that blank, you're taking in information, right?
Yeah, like a sponge. Like you take it in, and you got to be careful because you can take in way, way too much, you know, and it's not yours, and you got to just let it go.
Here's another one. Here's a tweet from Margot. So appreciate this discussion. I just love the term neurodiverse, which really can encompass any type of autism or, I guess, mental health issues, she adds. It sets the tone of acceptance for those who have felt the burn of being outsiders due to how they process thoughts and emotions. Larry, you want to respond to that?
Well, I agree again that the term is wonderful because it helps to remind us that we are all different. That said, yeah, I think actually just leaving it there is probably best.
Here's a question from Sue, and this is back to you, Sarah. If you had received your diagnosis as a child, do you think there's anything that could have helped you at the time assimilate more easily or fit in a little more comfortably?
Maybe. You know, I think when I think about my child, Cyrus, and things that might help him, I think that my mom was already doing some of the things, you know, just reacting to who I was as a person to be able to help me. You know, she would, something we used to do is practice making phone calls because I was terrified. And so, you know, she would walk me through, okay, you got to call the pharmacy. And I was like 9 or 10, see if they have the prescription in. And she told me what to say. And, you know, just helping me with building some of that confidence. Doing theater in school helped because it's a structured environment where I'm supposed to be loud and, you know, projecting my voice, learning lines and learning how to do social cues in like a scripted way, you know?
Oh, that's fascinating.
So that helped a lot, I think. when I was growing up.
And being another person. I mean, being a role as opposed to yourself.
Right, putting myself in someone else's shoes and what they would do was very helpful.
Wow. Here's a comment from Jim. My 26-year-old son just took a very well-paying job in data science after completing a BS and MS. His childhood was a little bumpy. Our school district was fabulously supportive and hung in there, but school was hard for him, socially speaking. He turned the corner junior year of high school after understanding that good grades were important and has sailed through ever since. I offer this encouragement to parents of rambunctious kids on the spectrum. Larry, anything you want to add to that?
Spirited. That is, I think, a word that we see a lot. There's actually a few good books about do you have a spirited child and how to work with them. And this gets back to the traits, and every child has what they're doing and how they're exhibiting in the world. So that's just – it's a wonderful story, and it's a good reminder that as long as we keep going forward and keep looking for those opportunities, if it's to put a child in improv, if it's Sarah with her musical talent playing the flute, just continue to seek out that comfort.
You know, I was curious about the pandemic. We all came in. We were wearing masks. We're now sitting – distance, but without masks. And I wonder for you, Sarah, whether having people wear masks, was that helpful or not helpful in terms of just sort of information, you know, that the face can give off, and even just more of us isolated at home and not going to work and being with other people. Mm-hmm. What has this been like for you?
Yeah, I think, and my experience is only going to be mine. You know, there's autistic people and people in general are all going to have different experiences of the last year. It's been very tough. I think setting aside the fact that we have young children at home, which just throws the whole thing into a different realm, being able to work from home and being able to not necessarily have to go to the grocery store or go into the office every day has been helpful for me just in terms of more restorative time for me to be able to process things. You know, it is difficult to always be on Zoom meeting people and not be able to be in a room and reading social cues. And I am excited to be able to get into more of that now, hopefully. But it has also been helpful for me to have some of this time to be able to reflect and process and not have to be so overwhelmed.
How about for you, Larry?
I miss reading people's faces. Yeah. I absolutely wish everyone had a clear mask. We should all be wearing masks, but if they could be clear so that I could still see if there's a smirk or a frown or what's going on. And I would say that for like our son Cyrus, he took to wearing the mask quickly because he understood it. And for him, it was not a barrier because we never made it a barrier. We still went out. We still participated in the world. I think that if we wouldn't have done that later last year when masks became what we were doing and he was just starting now, that it would be more of a struggle, both sensory because the mask is on your face and it's another constant touch. So finding a mask that worked for him was a big deal. But also just that interaction because he was learning how to intuit with people. And if you lose 2/3 of somebody's face, there's a bit of a challenge there.
Well, we have to leave it there. And I want to thank you both very much for joining us on Radio Times, coming into the station, Sarah, in particular, to you. And frankly, for writing this book, I learned a lot of stuff. So thank you.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And again, our guests have been Sarah and Larry Nannery. And again, their book is titled What to Say Next: Successful Communication in Work, Life, and Love with Autism Spectrum Disorder. Sarah Nannery is Director of Development for Autism Initiatives at Drexel University. And Larry is a technology consultant. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.